free my ship.
I shall do that, Kirk, when I'm ready.
I'm telling you now.
And I do the telling on this planet, Kirk, old boy. You do the listening.
All right, I'll listen. What are you telling?
Ooh, merely that you might as well start enjoying yourselves. It's really a very, very nice place. And you're all going to be here, quite probably, for the rest of your lives.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, sipping jippers on a beach somewhere while applying way too much bronzer.
Well, I'm glad you introed with that, because this week we're going to talk about a very special character, Leo Francis Walsh.
Cam, I don't believe that's his actual name.
Really?
Yeah.
He had me fooled. This week we're going to talk about the wacky course correcting of Harcourt Fenton Mudd, otherwise known as Harry Mudd.
Yeah, Cam, I think we wanted to touch on this one because it represents a very kind of peculiar situation in Star Trek, where you take a 50-year-old character where maybe you watch it back, you know, in the 1960s, 70s, and you're like, oh, what a rascally little rogue there.
Right.
You watch it now in modern time, and you're like, oh, this is a very problematic character, one who's engaged in a lot of misogyny, sex trafficking.
Yeah.
Just some stuff that it just does not sit well nowadays. And then Discovery, which seems to be the most woke Star Trek we've ever experienced, decides, oh, this is a character that we want to bring back. And it had us a little, like, baffled. Like, why would Star Trek Discovery want to pursue this very problematic character and bring him in? And I think what we want to do is kind of track his evolution and track why maybe the new era producers are actually kind of intrigued by what this character has to offer.
It's interesting because Harry Mudd, as created, as you said, is, you know, there's a lot of problems associated with that character in any sort of modern context. And yet he is a character we can't ignore. He's beloved by the fans. He's someone that...
Is he beloved by the fans?
I think he is to a certain degree. You see a lot of cosplayers doing Harry Mudd cosplay.
He's beloved by some fans.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's definitely, when you look at the original series icons, he's up there.
Oh, yeah.
He's on the totem pole of icons where, like, you're going to see him as a very recognizable one. He had an action figure in the 90s through Playmates. He's a character that, even though his
complete
roots...
Complete with comb-over?
Exactly. You know, he has all these issues attached to him from a 1966 creative standpoint, and yet he's made the journey the 50 years.
Yeah.
With fans and, you know, the Star Trek community at large, not really talking about him as any sort of problem character. I don't hear that. And I even went searching for this episode to look for maybe more critical looks at this character. People don't really make them. I mean, even when Discovery was going to bring this character back, I didn't even hear the writers on that show or Rainn Wilson really saying, like, this is a damaged character, but we think we can do a modern spin on him and make him more interesting. Like, they weren't even saying things like that.
Yeah.
It was very strange.
Well, look, before people think that we're just being too prickly, I think we need to kick it off with the very first Harry Mudd episode. Though.
Sure.
This is called Mudd's Women, Cam. Mm-hmm. And we're introduced to this character. He's not being all that honest about, say, his identity, nor his crew.
You're talking about Leo Francis Walsh, I assume.
That's what he calls himself there. And
yeah.
So what happens, though, is he gets his crew on board, but he refuses to call them his crew.
Mm-hmm.
He calls them my cargo.
Right.
They're women. He is pimping them. He's literally bringing them to be exchanged for goods on a mining colony.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at least Captain Kirk is a little bit mortified by the prospect of it. But
yeah.
So there is some acknowledgement that this is not an ideal situation. But I don't know what the message is behind this episode. It's a very frightening message and themes going on here. There's really not a lot of self-awareness on the part of the writers at the time about, like, how brutal this is.
This episode is fascinating to me, and rewatching it, it's an episode that, like, I don't really like it at all, but, like, it is an episode that supports a lot of essay writing if you want to write about an episode, because
yeah.
I think there's really interesting ideas at play. Like, Gene Roddenberry, when he's coming up with the idea for this episode, this was going to be potentially the pilot of Star Trek, the second pilot to get the green light for the show, and they ended up going with Where No Man Has Gone Before. Can you imagine this is a pilot? It's so weird.
I mean, like, if you're trying to introduce your captain, if you're trying to introduce your co-lead and Spock, mm-hmm. I don't think they have that many interesting things to do. As even look, the man trap, I think, or at least is at least better at setting them up.
Exactly. But I mean, Gene Roddenberry pitched the show as Wagon Train to the Stars. He wants to touch on frontier stories in space. One of the big elements of the frontier was women placing ads for mail order brides to guys who had gone out to the West to settle it. Like, it was incredibly common. And if you want to do this type of story, like, I can understand how Roddenberry's going, well, this would work in a West story. So what about this idea of these women who are going out? Because we meet the one, Eve, who says, like, there's nothing for me in my home. The idea of Harry Mudd being someone who's transporting them for that, like, they're paying him to do this. I think you might get an interesting story out of this. But the fact that they couch it in this really weird character who's dressed like a pimp, who is giving them drugs, it makes it all very icky. Like, I feel like there's a story there that you might be able to tackle, but they complicate it so much.
I can't agree with you with that, though. Like, I can't agree that there is a kind of contemporary story that you
can
tell.
It's like a Wild West trope that doesn't work in the 24th century or 23rd
century. It doesn't translate into either the modern era or into the future era. Just like, and from everything we gather from the Federation, you know, through our 50 years of knowledge, this situation would actually never actually unfold, though. It just makes absolutely no sense. But it's just such a bizarre thing to see realized on screen, in that, like, I know that they were taking it very literally when it comes to Wagon Train for the Stars, but I think about maybe a series like Deadwood, in which there are pimps on the show, there are prostitutes, they're fully realized three-dimensional human beings on both sides of this. Mm-hmm. It is brutal. They don't hold back punches. And there's almost this weird, it's a mix of this romanticized version of this, as well as this kind of very brutal version to a certain degree, because the guy keeps saying that the miner says, I didn't touch her.
Yeah, that's freaking weird.
It's very, very disturbing and creepy too.
Yeah, I mean, the miners are disheveled and, like, kind of like brutish looking. Like, they are not like coming there where it seems like a positive environment. Like, yes, I am looking for a wife because we're very, you know, unhappy here. It's like, these guys look like dangerous.
Yes.
Get these women away from them.
So I guess what we're ultimately getting at, though, is that, you know, Harry Mudd is a guy who would put people into that situation.
Yeah, and the guy who created Harry Mudd, Stephen Kendall, him and Roddenberry collaborated on this episode. Roddenberry came up with the drug that makes people look a certain way. Stephen Kendall was the one that came up with the character of Harry Mudd, and he wrote all the original series and animated Harry Mudd stories. And he had a quote where he said, I originally had the idea of a kind of traveling salesman and con man, the medicine salesman in Wizard of Oz that ends up as a wizard. An interstellar con man hustling whatever he can hustle. A light-hearted, cheerful, song and dance man version of a pimp. So right there in the description,
pimp
does not work. Like, yeah,
It does work up until the word pimp.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Like, you are now putting a playful spin on
sex trafficking.
Yes, like a very, very brutal type of individual.
And that's just it. Like, sex trafficking exists. We're not talking about, say, necessarily like prostitution. Like, you can go to, like, say, some Scandinavian countries, and women through their own volition will, say, choose to do this, so on and so forth. There are protections for them.
Or even, like, escort agencies here.
But even then, those are very much guilty of sex trafficking. When we talk about sex trafficking, it's essentially people kind of the most vulnerable out of society being put in situations kind of against their will. And so it's if you have a character who is kind of the lovable rogue who is facilitating this, I just don't know if there's much self-awareness. And maybe people didn't even really think about that back in the day. It just was not on the minds of people.
Although NBC was very uncomfortable with this episode.
Okay.
Like, when they pitched this as a potential pilot, NBC was like, haha, we don't know if we like this. And I don't know if that's because of the idea of a pimp character, or just the fact, in terms of, like, practices of what's allowed on TV, just the even air of something sexual would freak them out. I don't know.
Does it even sound like a good pilot idea?
the greatest of pilots. Yeah. Like, what is that? It's so weird.
So, okay, let's talk about the character as we know it and how he's introduced. He's introduced from the get-go as somebody who plays a lot with the truth, because it becomes very clear that he is not, in fact, one Leo Walsh, as he's calling himself, though. And he's got this weird accent. What would you describe this this speech mannerism here?
I have no idea.
Yeah. it's not even like a transatlantic accent or anything like that.
No, this is, Roger C. Carmel played Harry Mudd, and he gives him, I don't even know what to say. It's like a very over-the-top kind of voice, and it's interesting because Star Trek has all these ties to Shakespeare in its language. You hear constantly Shakespeare's reference throughout the history of the franchise. Harry Mudd feels like a low comedy character in a Shakespeare play, and it's like he is playing to the back of the room.
He's like Puck from A Midsummer's Night Dream or something.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. But it's like...
Or even like the wait staff that come in, you know, in between acts and just say something funny.
He's almost got like this Irish like brogue going on. And it's just like, okay. Like, I just wonder what that meant for the character, what that was supposed to imply for the character, though. Mm-hmm. Is the Harry Mudd, as he is displayed here, would you call him... like a psychopath or anything like that? I don't think that's what necessarily the show is going for. I think they wanted him to be very lovable.
There is a level of menace to him, though, that I can't say I really picked up as much on in past viewings, and that he does give across the airs of someone who could be dangerous. Part of it is, I think, just the stature of the actor. He was 6'3". He's a big dude, and he's standing next to Kirk, and I was like writing my notes, like, how tall is this guy? Like, in my mind, he's kind of a shorter guy, kind of jovial. And that when I see him really towering over Shatner, I go like, this guy looks kind of dangerous. And he's someone who's always playing the word game, the, you know, ways to get out of a situation, talking his way out. But in the back of my mind, I do feel like this character as portrayed on screen, what happens when he runs out of words? Like, I feel like this is a character who has that level of... this guy could get dangerous.
Like, backed into a corner.
Yeah, like, it's going to take a lot. Like, he's going to always want to bluster and con his way out. But I feel like if you're as successful as Harry Mudd is, or has been running as long as Harry Mudd is, there has to be some, you know, there must have been some damage in the past.
Okay, so look, we get Mudd's women here. Not an episode we're really fans of, but it is the introduction to Harry Mudd. And for whatever reason, they do decide to bring this character back. And I wonder how much maybe fan response has to do with that.
Yeah. I mean,
it's about
that,
a one...
or they just wanted to keep some sort of continuity. Like, maybe they thought this character could pop up every season because he is a con man.
They didn't care about continuity back then, though.
No, it's true. Maybe they just enjoyed writing for him.
Yeah,
I would imagine if you are writing Harry Mudd dialogue, it's fun.
But I wonder how much it is just the actor that's bringing this character to life, though. Because look, you can say we have our complaints about the character itself, but I don't think we're laying any blame on the actor who is bringing to life this otherwise very problematic character.
I thought it was interesting, though, rewatching Mudd's Women, and that when I watched the episode for this rewatch, it really doesn't feel like a Harry Mudd episode. Like, he's introduced off the top, and he kind of fades into the background to the overall story of that character of Eve.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I'm going like, what is this even saying about Harry Mudd? Like, I like the idea of this guy who is the fly in the ointment, the guy who is basically poking pins at this ideal humanity that exists. He's the guy who represents all of the base desires or instincts that humans used to have and had in the 1960s and, you know, still have to this day. And he's the one constantly reminding them and trying to weaken them with that. I like that idea. I think that is a really great idea. And maybe that was interesting enough that they thought, well, let's maybe bring this guy back as having a more prominent role and really wrap the episode around him.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we're talking about I, Mudd in season two. Earlier, Sean, I think is at episode 8 of season 2. And of course, this is where the android infiltrator commandeers the entire ship.
Yeah,
and
that guy's amazing.
Over 4 days.
Norman? His name was Norman, right?
There's not even like any attempts to take over the vessel once again from the crew. It's just they're like, we've been cruising 4 days and we're on an android planet with Harry Mudd.
Yeah.
He's the ruler. It's his own laws. He decrees everything. There's almost this more menacing kind of spirit about him, but I find him to be less problematic if we can kind of wipe away from our brains what happened in the previous episode.
Sure, there's a lot of misogyny still with the character and robot women.
Well, it's like, let's be honest, like, read between the lines. They're all about kind of, like, women, like literally built to please him,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
like, so that's an incredibly misogynistic sort of like thing for the writers to be doing. And I know people keep saying, well, it was the 1960s, it's a different era. Fans still love this sort of stuff, though. Like as you said, Cam, like, there are a lot of people still cosplaying it. I'm just wondering if, like, okay, like, do you really kind of get what the whole idea is behind this character, though, and we're kind of cheerleading for him?
I still wonder how much of that has to do with just the weird, confused messaging of the first episode. I think it was maybe clearer, like, really, really, really on the nose, people might react more strongly, whereas it's so couched in this weird, the women say that they want this, that it somehow gives him the benefit of the doubt to just a casual viewer who's not thinking about it.
That is right there, male fantasy, though.
Oh, totally.
Like, it's not like a realistic depiction of, as I said before, like the most vulnerable people mm-hmm. in the galaxy being thrust into these situations.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but going back to iMud, though, like the way that he's displayed here, I find him a little bit more menacing, and then B, I guess, a little bit more lovable simultaneously, in that, like, I can understand why they were having fun writing for this character, and they gave him more to chew on, I'd say.
Is it because with this episode they embraced his more villainous roots? The first one, as I've said a few times now, it was very confused in its messaging, whereas I feel like this one, he is the antagonist, and they have to stop him.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, he is kind of displayed as somebody who is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
He can, you know...
And very smart.
Facilitate the commandeering of the big Constitution-class starship.
Did that not remind you of, I think it's Brothers, where Data takes over the Enterprise?
And he's typing as fast as he's ever typed in his whole life before?
Yeah.
It did have a little bit of that to it, yeah.
Norman was the father of Data.
There you go. Norman Sung. That's yeah.
But I do love in iMud how they have to outsmart him in a way that is really fun, where they are saying things that are illogical to cause the androids to break down. It's essentially exposing all the errors that are built into any android that would be built by Harry Mudd,
yeah.
or that would essentially be reprogrammed, because he, I believe, inherited all these androids.
Yeah, they're from like the Andromeda galaxy.
Yes,
that's a bit of a jaunt.
Yeah, you know. Kevin Sorbo built them.
Thank you. But here, we also get a little bit more misogyny in the show with the introduction of Stella. You know,
this was introduced by David Gerrold, this element.
So this is the android version of his wife, mm-hmm. who is, if it's a wife, I guess the 1960s writers need to make sure that she is portrayed as a horrible nag.
Yeah, and this is the biggest cliche in the world.
An offensive cliche at that, and it just really reemphasizes the misogyny rampant throughout this character. And it's just, and let's be honest, like, the writers at the time, they, like, look, Star Trek had a lot going for it with regards to being progressive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they ever always did right by women, though, and this is on full display right here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong necessarily with writing a character that is misogynist. It's about how the other characters react to him.
But it's the self-awareness of the show itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no showcase of any sort of self-awareness here.
Like, you never get the sense that the Stella robot, the other crew is like, this is really messed up.
Yeah.
They're just like, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah. It sucks for you to have to spend time with a replica of your wife.
Wasn't there like 500 of them?
Couple, yeah.
Something, yeah.
So.
Yeah. I did appreciate, though, this episode. You know, it's called iMud. And it does seem somewhat inspired by Isaac Asimov with iRobot. He was a huge Star Trek fan. He's at the first Star Trek convention, you know, in the 70s. And I like that they're finding fun ways to play around with the idea of androids. And just watching the crew go through these hilarious shticks, I thought was really fun. Like,
well, the gifs of them dancing that persist to this day, I love them to death.
I just love, like, was it Spock who's like, I love you, I hate you? Things like that. Like, Star Trek comedy episodes are spotty. I think having Harry Mudd as a comedy character is really problematic, but I think this one is actually somewhat watchable.
Much more so than Mudd's women.
Yeah. And they were going to do a third Mudd story called Deep Mudd, where he escaped that planet and got together with some space pirates and brought in advanced weaponry that he couldn't control. Ultimately, that episode was going to happen, and Roger C. Carmel just wasn't available.
Well,
so they ended up having to put that one on ice.
The good news is the string of misogyny rampant throughout this character persists with the animated episode.
Yeah. Also written by Stephen Kandel.
Okay.
Yeah. Very prolific TV writer. He wrote a lot.
Did he now?
Oh my God, yes.
Mannix?
Probably.
Okay.
He wrote a lot on the Batman 66 show, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Mudd's Passion, the animated episode from 73, Roger C. Carmel's back. And I'm not embarrassed to say I laughed out loud quite a few times in this episode. Not at the misogynistic stuff, though. More just some of the goofier side moments. What was your thought on this one?
Of course, you have to reduce a woman to her pure emotions here. We have Nurse Chapel still obsessed with Spock.
Yeah.
And she's willing to essentially betray her oath to Starfleet in order to pursue, you know, a love potion, essentially.
Yeah.
And I'm just like...
Love potions are like the oldest gimmick.
But I'm just like, oh boy. And this is also something made directly for children. It's like, you know, great role models that you're putting on display here.
It really does no favors to the character of Chapel at all. Like, I think it would have, if you want to go this route, I think you could have done it in a way where it wasn't like Chapel being in a position of looking after Harry Mudd and failing at her duty. I think there's several ways an imaginative storyteller could have said, okay, how do we have Harry Mudd somehow slip these potions out there?
Yeah.
I think it would be easy. But I didn't even understand the rules that much, because he says it where it's like, one touch means friendship between men and women, love women towards men. And I was like, what? I rewound it, and I'm like, I don't understand. And what I think it means is, if it's same sex, they become friends. Is that what it means?
I guess so.
Because there's the part where Kirk and
Spock really
touch
trying
each
other.
I was trying to break this down, Tyler. Okay. But there's the part where Kirk and Spock touch each other on like the shoulder, and then are like, you're my best friend. So it's a very heterosexual you know, potion, I guess.
But was there not a lot of like homoeroticism like throughout this? Do you think that was intentional on the part?
No, I don't think that was intentional.
Okay, I'm just saying, by then, like, the slash fiction was out there, though. Like, that was still kind of a... It was, like, more underground at the time, but I don't know. I wonder if they're having a little fun with it, though.
In a children's animated show, you think?
I don't know.
I don't know. Like, if this was a, you know, one of the episodes of the series, I would say, you know, the regular series, I would say maybe. Okay. But in a, like, half-hour children's show that they're really cranking out on the cheap, I don't know. But what did you think of this portrayal of Harry Mudd? Like, did it feel like any sort of evolution from when we last saw him in I, Mudd?
Well, he's still... Okay. So he's still on the trajectory of misogyny, but he's also on the trajectory of becoming a little bit more lovable, you know? And I'd say if you're doing a children's show, it makes sense there.
There's no menace, really, to him in this portrayal.
I would say it's more of a goofy adventure more than anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, I still don't understand how this lizard could be this woman shapeshifter sort of dealio.
Yeah, like the Rigelian hypnoid?
Yeah. I was like, okay, it made me think of Hypnotoad from Futurama, which you have not watched, but...
I know of the Hypnotoad.
Yeah.
If you're on the internet, you know what the Hypnotoad is.
That's true. So, So this is our trilogy of old school Harry Mudd showcases. Here.
I will say, I did totally laugh out loud when they want to beam back to the ship and it just cuts back to them dancing.
I literally
burst out laughing because it had this weird elevator music.
Yeah.
And just the reaction shots to crowds that aren't moving is always funny to me.
Yeah.
I keep coming back to the idea of the theme of Harry Mudd in this character who's targeting the weaknesses of humans that, in theory, in Roddenberry's utopia, we have left behind.
Yeah, well, okay, maybe that's something that is worth discussing here, though, is that he is out of his element in this universe that's one Roddenberry's created. And as you say, this utopia, though. And is it good for him to be a reminder there? You know, he doesn't quite fit in, but it is kind of an interesting element that's, I think, stands in complete opposition to what we know about the Federation, which means that it's not this monolithic entity as we often think it
is. And if he does come across in his misogyny to a viewer as sort of grotesque, I think that's really interesting because it makes us recognize that, hey, you know, some of the things going on in our own society are grotesque. And this is 23rd century commenting on the era the viewer is watching the show, which is interesting in a way. I just wish that maybe... Who knows? Maybe the episode Deep Mudd would have done this, but Harry Mudd had been used to comment on something other than they keep just going back to this whole quote unquote love idea or sex, whatever Harry Mudd is peddling. It always feels like the same thing. I would have liked if maybe they had one of these three at least appearances, have him doing some different type of con. If he's an opportunist, make him someone who's trying to succeed at all costs and will peddle you anything. And so I think it would be fun to see an episode where he was trying to sell them something or dupe them into something that maybe targeted a different weakness in human society.
Yeah. So the other thing that he seems to be really into are minerals, whether he's servicing miners or getting love crystals.
Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah, miners are mentioned in all three Harry Mudd stories.
He's
always duping miners.
But is that really a surprise, considering how obsessed Star Trek is with mining?
It's like so weird.
Everywhere they go, it's mining colony. Mm-hmm. So Cam, look, we've got like this 50-year gap, and then they're like
50 years.
Yeah,
that's a long time.
Let's bring back this character who is a jolly old fellow.
Yeah,
but very problematic. And as you said in your research, not a lot of people out there really bring attention to this. But you heard me when I first heard that Star Trek Discovery wanted to bring back Harry Mudd. All I could ask was why. And yeah. Why him? And I think you had an explanation for this. But I was like, well, look, if you want a rascally rogue, like why him versus like a Cyrano Jones? You know, like they're both right. Kind of similar characters, but Cyrano Jones is much less problematic. He's just kind of a goofball sort of con man. Why do you think they were drawn to a Harry Mudd? Is it just because he's that much more iconic?
Does Cyrano Jones have a thematic core to the character? Or is he just kind of a... You know, just kind of a con man who sold them tribbles.
Yeah, he's just kind of a tribble peddler.
Yeah, whereas yeah. I feel like Harry might, just in terms of the ideas of him targeting these people's weaknesses that, you know, should be long gone, there's at least a narrative angle to using that character.
Yeah.
Like Cyrano Jones, you could completely reinvent. I don't think it's, insane to ask that maybe they take that character and do more with him. They would do that with lots of characters. But I think Harry Mudd has that standing, that name value. Like when you throw out Rainn Wilson playing Harry Mudd, I think that's a splashier headline than Rainn Wilson playing Cyrano Jones.
It also helps that he's had three episodes named after him. I think he's just more ingrained in Star Trek culture than a Cyrano Jones.
I mean, the costume alone is iconic.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm wearing it right now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they had teased that Nick Frost might play Harry Mudd in the Kelvin verse. They thought that would be fun to have him pop up in a cameo. I'd be curious if they would have had him in that outfit.
Well, do you recall that in Star Trek Into Darkness, they do make reference to the Mudd incident?
Yeah.
So he is out and about in the Kelvin verse as well. Yeah. So that I guess that was our intermediate reference to Harry Mudd in those decades there. But with
do you think we missed out with Nick Frost?
Yeah, but would it have changed my concerns about having like this problematic character? But yeah, I would say Nick Frost's Harry Mudd would have been a lot of fun. For those like not familiar, he's the one that you'd see in those Cornetto trilogy movies, the ones that Edgar Wright directs, Hot Fuzz, you know, The End of the World, those kinds of movies. And he's kind of like the no disrespect to Nick Frost, but you could call him kind of the schlubby sidekick to a certain degree.
Yeah. I do feel though that while he would have been fun, it would have been probably something of a cameo that probably wouldn't have amounted to a lot to really discuss in terms of that character's journey.
Yeah.
But getting back to Discovery, we first, re-encounter Harry Mudd in a prison cell, which seems very fitting, in the episode Choose Your Pain, where we have Lorca and Ash Tyler, two characters who I always imagined facing off against a wacky con man.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, just think about it. But that's actually a good point, though, because you can understand like maybe a Captain Kirk kind of bouncing off of Harry Mudd in a certain way. Ash Tyler, maybe the one character in Star Trek has the least amount of sense of humor ingrained in the character.
Yeah.
I think Lorca is an interesting foil, though, because he is distinct from Captain Kirk, so you don't feel as if you're just hitting the same beats there.
And he's also a con man.
We didn't know it at the time, though.
We didn't.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, it was two cons facing off against each other.
Oh, did the writers even know it at the time?
I don't know. That's an excellent question. I'm trying to think. By episode 5, did they know?
Well, remember, we were at the convention and Jason Isaacs was like, the writers told me that, before I signed on, we think you're from the Mirror Universe. We don't really know why. And we don't really know why you're here.
Yeah.
But do you want to be Lorca? He's like, okay. So it still annoys me when he's giving that speech about the USS Baran and how he just hates Klingons.
Right.
It's like, no, it's all just made up.
Yeah.
So anyways, beyond that, though, con man versus con man here. And I guess Lorca ends up on top, though, because he's able to out-con one Harry Mudd.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ash Tyler figured out this is always a two-man escape job and he could never trust Harry Mudd. And look, we have one con man Lorca figuring out very quickly because Stewart Harry's little scorpion pet has a listening device in it.
Yeah.
Does this seem a little bit elaborate on the part of the Klingons? Could the Klingons not have planted a listening device, like, on their own in, like, I don't know, like, the ceiling?
Or, like, the face paint?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know why Harry Mudd was integral to this, but you got to give him something to do there. So yeah. Lorca figures it out, and he's like, look, you're a traitor. Why would I trust you there? So he had much less screen time, you know, like, just full minutes on the show that I actually remembered him having, though.
Yeah, that's true. I did appreciate, though, that they really gave Harry Mudd this very dangerous edge in this, you know, kind of reinvention for Discovery, and that
steals people's food.
He steals their food. He's willing to have people beaten to death in front of him. He's a survivor, and he talks about how, and who knows how much of this is honest, and I think that's something I want to talk about when we get to a couple more Harry Mudd stories. But, he's someone who talks about, you know, I've had it with, say, like, the Klingons versus the Federation, us being caught in the crossfire, us, those of us who are just out there in the universe. This is an element of the Star Trek universe that I find really interesting. It's something that Star Wars did reasonably well, where you had these offshoot planets like Tatooine, for example, where they weren't involved in the Galactic War.
Or in Firefly, there's the central planets versus the outer rim.
Exactly, know? Yeah. So I like the idea of Harry Mudd kind of representing maybe some of these criminal underbelly type figures that have zero interest in the ongoing settling of the frontier.
But he also brings up a good philosophical point, though, where, you know, Lorca and Tyler were like, we didn't start this war. The Klingons, you know, they fired on us. So if that's the case, I still have to wonder why one Burnham was thrown into a mining prison, all for insubordination there, court-martialed and everything.
Too bad Harry Mudd wasn't in that one. Yeah. Another mining mention.
But the issue that Harry Mudd strikes back with, though, is like, well, I don't know, like, what do you think's going to happen if you keep bumping up to somebody's front door? Mm-hmm. What do you think you're going to do? If you keep taunting the dog, they're going to bite at you eventually. And it's an interesting worldview where we're always kind of told that the Federation is this idealistic, you know, benevolent sort of organization. But is that really how they're viewed by every single entity out there? I don't think it is.
Yeah.
And he's bringing that to screen.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that Harry Mudd has a worldview here. I would not say he has a worldview in the original series or the animated episodes. And that, again, you don't know how much to trust what Harry Mudd is ever saying. But I feel like even if we just have to take it at face value as maybe just being a con on top of a con, he is at least voicing something that others would agree with in that, you know, the idea that those who don't belong to the Federation and the Klingons may just be getting really annoyed with things like, you know, this ongoing war, like what a struggle it is for them.
So we have a kind of an interesting little dichotomy here in how we can interpret the character as we find it in the Discovery era, because what we do know is that this is 10 years before, you know, the Kirk era of Harry Mudd. So from your perspective, do you find that there is a solid through line about, like, the Carmel character versus the Wilson character, or do they almost come off as two entirely different characters that just kind of share a name to a certain degree with a couple, you know, familiar elements tied into them?
I found it kind of bizarre when I was reading up on interviews with the show creators of Discovery about their decision to bring in Harry Mudd, and they talked about how what really drew them in was the idea of doing the origin story of Harry Mudd. And so I guess in their minds, this is more or less the beginning of the Mudd journey.
But he already seems as if he's been on this journey.
Does. I think it
Rainn
was
Wilson is not a young man.
No, you know? I have real question marks about the origin idea. If that was their intention, I'm not sure they succeeded.
Yeah.
But
maybe the idea, though, was like, oh, well, he's thrown in prison and he's left behind. And that's where he really gives up on humanity.
Yeah.
Even though he was kind of an arms dealer, right? By that point, we already found out that he was involved with arms dealing.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I know they mention it later, but didn't they also reference homicides, attempted homicides?
So that was actually in The Escape Artist.
Had they not mentioned it before that?
I can't. I can only speak to The Escape Artist for sure.
Yeah. For sure. It does feel weird in that the Harry Mudd that we saw in the original series, they're going through his rap sheet. It's like two things. It's sure. like theft of a vehicle.
Yeah.
And like, what was it? Not having a master's license? God, I love it when original series does like mundane criminal charges.
He did not plot a course. That's what it was. Like, it's like if you, because Gene Roddenberry is like a pilot. So yeah. He's like, well, if you're a pilot, you have to plot a course or else you can get like fined. And yeah. so, yeah, that's what one of his crimes was.
Yeah. He also had an expired master's license, as I recall. Wow. But yeah. like, I love that that's the sort of issues that this character has. But yeah, that's the thing, like, you know, as you said, does the Rainn Wilson one line up? It doesn't, and that they really are making this character out of the gate feel much more dangerous.
Yeah.
And unless we're going to see some sort of a little bit of mellowing on the character where he becomes more of the con man, as opposed to here he seems legitimately dangerous, like someone who will slit your throat if given a chance. But I don't know. Like,
well, then you know what? Let's jump forward to Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, because this is, to me, is actually what I think shows kind of self-awareness on the part of the creators for the first time ever, though. Is like, he is showcased as a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
He's literally murdering people aboard the ship. And it is actually kind of displayed in a way that's horrifying to watch. You see all these people being disintegrated,
yeah.
and he is unrepentantly just like blasting them away. And I'll say this, one of the best sequences that we've seen so far in Star Trek Discovery is all the ways Harry Mudd has devised to murder Lorca in that like little yeah. montage there. Even just the way it was filmed, it was fun to
watch.
Oh,
it's awesome. The idea of pairing Harry Mudd against Lorca is really fun, because Lorca is such a dark character who comes across as not likable a good deal of the time. And so you really do kind of struggle back and forth as to whose side you even want to take in the Lorca versus Mudd battle. You know, whereas with Kirk, you're like, I'm on Kirk's side.
Yeah.
With Lorca, it's more of kind of a, I mean, I guess I'm on Lorca's side because he's Starfleet, but he also seems like a lunatic. So I don't really know. And this episode is really fun to see Harry Mudd coming back to get revenge on him. And what I liked about this is that it's tapping into, and I mean, Choose Your Pain does it as well, but it's tapping into, I think, the dark humor of the Harry Mudd character really, really skillfully. I don't know that I would say there was a real sense of dark humor with the original series version.
It is very broad.
Yes, it's incredibly broad, you know, cued to wacky music.
Yeah.
Whereas the Discovery one, they are really tapping into the really, like, almost Coen Brothers dark comedy of this character.
Well, he's literally, like, throwing weaponized dark matter at Ash Tyler and yes. watching him disintegrate on the floor. And I don't know, it is a very dark sort of situation.
But introduced in outlandish ways, where he's coming inside a space whale wearing a wacky helmet.
I love that helmet, though.
I was reading an interview quote from the costume designer who said it was an Andorian style.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh, I can't really picture.
There's the antennae.
I know there's the antennae, but I'm like, I never really thought of that as being an Andorian look.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, as soon as I saw it when we watched it a couple years ago, I was like, that's an Andorian helmet.
Did you?
Okay. Oh, yeah. I think I even mentioned it on the podcast.
You might have. Yeah. That was a long time ago. Okay, my memory's not that good.
I can tell. I know. What's my name again?
Exactly.
Where am I?
How did I get on this podcast?
Harry who?
Yeah, exactly. But again, this episode, I mean, this was my favorite from season one of Discovery.
Yeah,
it just
same here.
Feels tonally like they have this thing nailed. And I think we said it on the podcast at the time. This is how to use Harry Mudd in a 21st century Star Trek story.
Well, look, he's menacing. They're having fun with it.
They've got a great high concept hook for him.
Yeah, more crystals. This time, not love crystals, but time crystals. But
yeah.
Look, he's menacing. They're having fun with it. And they are self-aware of like what a dangerous character this is as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, are we cheering for Harry Mudd during this? No, we're cheering for our protagonist. We're cheering for one, Burnham, as well as Stamets, to kind of figure out the situation, outplay the con man.
Yeah.
So this is twice in a row that we've had, I guess, the Starfleet characters get the upper hand on Harry Mudd. Although, ultimately, Starfleet does keep getting the upper hand on this guy.
Yeah.
You can understand why he really does resent Starfleet by the time that we meet him, by the time Kirk and company meet him.
Maybe that's the origin story.
Yeah.
Element.
So, Cam, unfortunately, we did not get a season two appearance from Harry Mudd, because look, by the time we got to Discovery season one's conclusion, I was like, okay, you know what? You've won me over. I am down for some more Harry Mudd adventures.
Yeah.
nothing in season two, but prior to that, we did get a short Trek featuring him in The Escape Artist, which this is the most consecutive screen time Harry Mudd has ever gotten before. Mm-hmm. And I think it was all put to good use. This is written by Mike McMahon, who we now know is going to be running the new animated series Star Trek Lower Decks. And I think this is good news for Harry Mudd because they're having fun within this universe while making it clear that Harry Mudd's not really a good actor within the universe, though. It's like, it's not just Starfleet that has problems with him. It's every single entity that he encounters. He's just not somebody who plays or accepts any of the rules that exist within galactic society.
Yeah, no, totally. And this episode plays up all the elements we know about Harry Mudd and kind of reframes them. Because obviously with the first two Harry Mudd stories, they were not touching on some of the really problematic stuff in the original series episodes. Whereas I feel like with the Escape Artist, they're kind of folding all the history of Harry Mudd together and kind of explaining how, in many ways, this character is not even knowable. Like, who is Harry Mudd?
Well, we only get to see him for a few split seconds at the end because essentially, spoiler alert for those who haven't caught the short Trek, that the Harry Mudd adventures that we're following throughout this, they're actually just androids, which brings us back to one iMud.
Yes.
Which I love. That's such a great call out. We even have his very familiar nautical themed outfit displayed at the end there. So it's really just the real Harry Mudd that we get to see. You know, he's actually being successful right now.
Yeah.
He is actually successfully conning people throughout the galaxy by selling himself, essentially.
Like for bounty.
Yeah, by giving up androids. So to me, it's also, I think we learned that maybe Discovery is at its best when it's not taking itself so seriously. Mm-hmm. And doing a fun episode like this with a character introduced, or I should say reintroduced in Star Trek Discovery, I think it's kind of, it hit the right notes tonally for me.
The thing that's really fascinating about this episode, though, for me, is from the point of view of a character, as we're seeing all these different androids going through the shtick that we know of Harry Mudd, they're touching on like all the elements of the character. All these androids are giving convincing performances of who Harry Mudd is as a character to us so that we don't expect the big reveal because this has behaved like Harry Mudd the whole time. And we get Harry Mudd, as you said, at the very end. And he's such an over-the-top presence, and he is a con man. And so I do wonder at the end of the day, do we even know who Harry Mudd is?
Yeah.
If all these androids are all based on performance, is Harry Mudd, as we see him, a performance?
Is he a knowable person?
Exactly.
Yeah. So maybe moving forward, though, I don't know how likely it is Harry Mudd will be making reappearances on Star Trek Discovery based on where we leave in this season two finale.
It's too bad because with his last appearance in the normal show on Magic, they introduced or reintroduced Stella.
Yeah.
Introduced for the first time actually in the flesh. And they even rewrote her a bit where her father is an arms dealer who's very successful. And they give her a lot more agency. Like, you get the sense that she's the one that might be running the show when it comes to her and Harry. And I would like to see that dynamic played with more. It's something that I'm not necessarily heartbroken if Harry Mudd doesn't show back up on Discovery, but that is an element that I think would have been interesting to see of a little more of, like, who is Stella and what is her say in all this?
Yeah, I would be down for another short Trek. But look, if we get a hypothetical Pike spinoff set in the 23rd century, I just don't think Harry Mudd can show up on that. It just doesn't make sense from a continuity level. Spock's going to know who this fella is. You're telling me that no one else, like, this is not his first time on the Enterprise? I don't know. The best you can do with is, let's say, if there's some ancillary characters on this spinoff that encounter him on a planet or something. Like, I don't know. I just don't know what the history really, or what the future really holds for Harry Mudd moving forward.
I mean, I know that they mentioned a while back that we're considering spinoffs on everyone, including Harry Mudd. And we'd said, well, if you did like some sort of half-hour sitcom in the mode of The Escape Artist, that could work.
Yeah. We're not so sure.
We haven't heard anything since, though.
But we're not so sure we'd want to watch like a 45-minute...
Like a drama?
Well...
that would be a bit much.
Yeah, like I think it'd work for more of those kind of comedy dramas, sort of like give him 20 to 30 minutes a week. Works for me. despite the fact that he started off as a very problematic character that I never wanted to see again, the fact that they've reinvented him, course-corrected to such a degree that I'm okay with him getting a spinoff, it's a big testament to Rainn Wilson bringing this to life. He even directed The Escape Artist as well.
And the writers, who really did take a character that doesn't belong outside of the 60s, early 70s, and managed to have him become a character that actually raises interesting questions that are the types of things we want to ask in the Star Trek universe.
Well, and that's just it. Look, I like the times in which Star Trek gives us a glimpse of human society beyond just the perfect entities, specimens of humanity that we always see. Bashir's father is like a perfect example of that. Like, it's nice to see just a constant, you know, screw-up civilian on display here.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because what is the legacy of Harry Mudd? I think there's a bit of a legacy to, like, Mudd's women. You can see that in an episode like The Perfect Mate or Bound, where they are kind of revisiting that type of story and taking different looks at it. But, like, what is the, do you think, the legacy of a Harry Mudd character?
I still think that the legacy is tied to his TOS appearance, though, in that, like, the most iconic version of it is still the TOS version. And I think we get the sense that, because of CBS All Access's limited, you know, penetration into homes across the world, that the Rainn Wilson version just hasn't quite, you know, hits beyond those of the really hardcore Star Trek fans, though. So I think the legacy of Harry Mudd, it's a problematic character for us. A lovable little rogue for most people. And if Rainn Wilson's able to kind of continue doing it, look, he's had as many appearances as his character as Roger Carmel has. I don't know. He can make it his own. I have a lot of fun with it, and a lot of fun, you know, for me to watch it, though. Like, I didn't enjoy watching a lot of these Harry Mudd adventures early on, because it's like, just like, too much of it just doesn't sit well with me. I don't know. I was watching, like, episodes of The Office, like, you know, that first went on, like, 10 years ago, right?
Sure.
Bringing it all back to Rainn Wilson. But, you know, like, there's a lot of, like, gay jokes that, you know, I was, like, laughing at, like, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You go back and they're really cringeworthy now. And it just shows you how much society and how quickly society can change, you know, in the drop of a dime.
I mean, comedy tends to age like soggy bread. It's, you know, some comedies hold up. Some do, but the most of them don't.
Yeah.
I mean, no, even if they're like PG family comedies, you'll watch them like 15 years later and be like, holy smokes, what were they thinking?
That said, Dumb and Dumber still holds up.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I was just curious, though, the idea, the DNA of the Harry Mudd character, not the Harry Mudd specifically, like, as a character, but, like, do you see a legacy of Harry Mudd, the DNA of the con man type character throughout the rest of the Star Trek franchise? Like, did that inspire similar types of characters? Because I look at a character like Rasmussen in TNG, I even question to a certain degree a character like Q, who is this unpredictable fly-in-the-ointment character who's always posing questions to challenge this utopia. It's interesting to think of Harry Mudd as sort of the father of, I would argue, better characters.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of an interesting theory there. I would think that maybe there's kind of like universal themes that the writers are very much interested in. And maybe Harry Mudd is maybe kind of the first time that they got to tap into that.
Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what do we do next time?
Cam, so coming up this weekend, it's going to be the big San Diego Comic-Con. There's going to be a giant Star Trek panel going on. We're talking about Discovery, Picard, Lower Decks. There's going to be lots of news coming in out of that. I think we're going to delve into everything fresh. It's going to be fun, and it's going to give us more ideas about what to expect in the coming months moving forward for the Star Trek franchise. And we can also talk about our theories about what this is going to entail. The other thing that we should announce, though, is that it looks to be official. There are some question marks, but it looks as if you and I will be going to Las Vegas to do a live subspace panel. So if you're going to be at the big convention coming up first week of August, be there, because Cameron and I will be there. Talking about, you know, do we want to reveal it or do we want to keep it a little secret?
I think let's keep it a secret.
But if you're...
It's a really fun topic. And if you're excited about some of the upcoming Star Trek shows, we're going to be working some of that in there. It's going to be, I think, a fun, lively panel.
Yeah, so that's tentatively scheduled for Thursday, 9:30 a.m., so hopefully you're not too hungover after karaoke with the Klingons.
That's right. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in valuable cudgel, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Norman the Android.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. So I kissed him upside the cranium.
Transfer complete.